Hey, Rick, I'd like you to join me on our makeshift stage here. Could I have the one of the handheld mics, Bob?
Here, turn me off.
Turn me on.
Sorry.
Line I bring up. You're the first church that there's more people sitting on the right than on the left. Check it out. Obviously, this is a conservative group. Except from where we're looking now, they're all on the left. So I guess it's better.
Rick, it's great to have you here today. What we want to do for the next stretch of time is just chat a little bit. I told Rick I was going to be a straight man this morning for him to read some of his poems, and then I hope that we will whet your appetite enough for you to come back here at 4 o'clock. And Rick will be holding forth a little further. We're going to have a reception afterwards. I got to thinking, I know some of you are taking part in the crop walk this afternoon, but that should be done by 4 o'clock. It's too wet out there to rake your leaves. It's a bye week for the Patriots, so there's no football to watch, and the Red Sox didn't make it to the World Series. You see, you got nothing left to do. But
are the Oakland Raiders playing?
They probably are somewhere.
I go once a year with my good friend, and we sit in the black hole. Raider Nation. All right.
Let's see, Rick, we first met quite a while ago, early 1990s, I believe. I was taking actually a youth group from the church here. This is back when I did sleep-bump floors in churches. I don't do that too much anymore, but took a youth group here, I think it was about 1991, 92, somewhere in there, and we were bunking out at the All Souls Church in New York, and you happened to be doing a gig there. That was when John Burens was the co-minister with Forest Church, and he introduced us, and we chatted around for a little bit, and you went on to do your thing there. And I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, we reconnected to a mutual friend of ours, a friend of mine named Jerry Simino, who runs a big bookstore in Monterey. And I was visiting Jerry, and he said, Jerry, I'm getting ready to take a trip down to Big Sur the next day. And he said, well, on the way down, I want to stop off at this poet friend of mine to pick up some of his books I can put in my store. I don't know if you know him or not. His name's Rick Maston. I said, I know Rick Maston. Yeah. So that was how we reconnected again, and it's been great coming up to visit you there in Carmel.
I'd like to ask, how many people here have heard me in another state? Usually there's a few more. I've been doing it since 1968. I once had a guy call back after we and said, I've even seen you in an altered state.
I was going to ask you, jumped on my, I was going to ask you what kind of state you were talking about.
You
got to
be quick.
But you got to be quick, right. But it's been great reconnecting, visiting with Rick. He lives just south of Carmel, California, as you're going into the Big Sur area there. Only thing about getting to your house is you have to drive up the side of a dirt road about an angle like so with no guardrail. Kind of scares the bejesus out of me every time I come to see you, but I've always made it there and back.
I haven't tried it in the rain.
All right, well, maybe I'll get that opportunity. One thing what we'd like to do is Rick's going to be reading some poems from his recently released collection. Is it Words in One-Liners 2?
Yeah,
and we got a stack of them on the table in there during coffee hour, so I hope you'll come and pick one up as well. Several sections in the book, I said I was going to be a straight man, so I think, Rick, we'll start with some of your family's things. You've got, what, two daughters and a son?
And three daughters and a son.
Three daughters and a son. And a grandson who's transporting you around here on this show.
Yes, he's at the table. Yeah. Is there a doctor in the house?
And the doctor's in the house. Now the doctor can go to the table. But I was kind of taken by the one you wrote about a couple of your granddaughters who were doing a construction, I think, called Pony Island, and then how it was all over with, you had to dismantle it. That's on page 43. Give us a run on that.
Well, I got this too, so I'm 76, so everything seems to be coming apart. And the book is called Words of One-Liners, and that doesn't mean it has tricky. I illustrate every poem with a single-line drawing. And this is a book that 5-year-olds enjoy more than maybe the adults, because every 5-year-old has to chase the whole thing to be sure he didn't cheat. Pony Island. Submerged in sadness, I acknowledge the relentless passage of time. Pony Island is gone, and oddly the demolition was done by me. I say oddly, because from the 19th of July to the 12th of August, I watched entranced while my visiting granddaughters worked the fantasy out in the dirt driveway below my writing room window. Kara, the solemn 9-year-old bossing the job, with Gaia, a lively firecracker 5, taken on as the tireless gopher. The two of them spending the long summer afternoons raiding the wood box, pilfering my tools out of the shop, digging and scraping, shaping the pliable surface into every little girl's enchanted sandbox dream. Barn and stable, paddock and polo field, a steeplechase, a racetrack, pastures, pond and streams, all surrounded by a bright blue water, an equestrian ballyhoo set in the center of a make-believe sea. Pony Island, Kara proclaimed, as Gaia meticulously, breathlessly, endlessly explained the intricate topography. But as previously revealed, this enchanted domain is no more, because for reasons I have yet to understand, the moment I returned home from the airport, I went with shovel and rake in hand directly to the now abandoned building site, and almost without thinking, strangely driven a man possessed, I thoroughly policed the area, returning blocks and sticks to the wood box, filling in ditches, furrows, and holes, removing the carefully placed rocks and twigs, raking and watering until there was nothing left. Nothing except the awful melancholy inside, at the center, like an island, and the sound of hoofbeats racing off down a deserted beach, disappearing the way time does.
Thank you.
Thank you. I learned this when I was a 19-year-old in Paris, and I went to hear Edith Piaf, and after her first number, I jumped up one
bravo!
Nobody in the audience, they all turned around to see who the idiot was. And then one poem, I realized one song led into another, and they don't break up the flow of things, but to ask an audience not to applaud is a little bit fat-headed. So could I get you all to rub your hands together like this? Now listen to that. Doesn't interrupt and allows you to say you like something. So rather than clapping, just do that.
That's good. That's great.
All right.
Well, we have several things in common, probably things not so, but we are both Unitarian Universalist ministers. You've been in the business a little longer than I have. We both like to try our hand at writing, although you've got about at least 10 times more books to show for it than I do. But we've dealt with what it means to be a writer, to try to be a composer of words, and what it means to have them accepted on the one hand and rejected on the other, which is why I got a particular kick out of your poem, "I Should Have Slept on It." I believe that's on page 59. I should have slept on it.
Now this afternoon, I'm gonna let the audience, they'll just yell numbers out. They don't know, they won't have the book. Of course, they won't really know whether I'm looking at what they call, but it's... and the reason I do this is I'm sure you've experienced this, that when you speak a lot, you begin to develop a little program that you know has the humor, and then pretty soon after you do that same program 3 times, Your body can do it, and you don't even have to be there. But like this afternoon, I have no idea what I did. He wanted to tell me, and I said, I don't want to know. I want to have this be kind of spontaneous. So I should have slept on it. Being published means something only on the date of publication. Had I known this, I would never have listed my occupation as poet when filling out and filing my income tax forms. I would have been better off had I described myself as voyeur or manic depressive. I can see now I should have slept on it. Accomplishments never seem to survive a good night's sleep. The rejection ship slips, however. The dead ends are always there in the morning, like that bully kid who gave me such a hard time on my way to school, sneering, asking me again today, and what is it you really do for a living? You know, nobody can believe that you can make your living as a poet, but I have done just that since 1968.
Good enough. All right. There you go. That's worth a response right there. I got a special kick out of reading one of your, well, I get a kick out of reading a lot of them, but the one that brought back a memory for me was of a time when I very briefly, in the basement of a church in Washington, D.C., had a short conversation with Joan Baez. She and I were both there when I was in theological school. I was involved in an organization called Clergy and Laity, concerned about Vietnam at the height of that war, and we were there for a rally, and Joan Baez wasn't performing. She just happened to be sitting there in the congregation. And at one point, the person who was moderating it, who was William Sloan Coffin, said, well, we need a break. Why don't you come up here and lead us in a few songs, Joan? And about three pews in front of me, Joan Baez stands up and leads the people in singing. Well, a little later, I was walking through the basement of this during a break in the meetings. And all of a sudden, I looked up, and walking right straight toward me down the hall was Joan Baez. Now, this is a time when you were supposed to be very cool about these things, you know. We're all in the movement together. Nobody's better than anybody else. We're all on the same plane here, fighting the same battle, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to maintain that composure. And I say hello, and I shake hands, and I have a very pleasant little banter of a conversation. Of course, inside I'm going, my God, my God, my God, my God, I'm standing here on my own. I know. Very cool demeanor, whereas in the inside I'm going a little nuts with it. Which was why I got such a kick out of reading your poem about your encounter, which is called The Fan. So give that one a go.
And by the way, just to show you, there is a one-line drawing I did of the way Joan looked when I met her. You ask, do I know Joan Baez? Well, let me count the ways. It was the summer of 67. In the afterglow of Big Sur celebration, she was barefoot and wore a blue velvet gown. Her presence filled the room, and children followed her around. We had a friend in common who brought us together, laughing as we joggled cups and saucers from one hand to the other. Her touch was firm and cool, and though 100 years go by, I'll not forget what Joni had to say the day we held each other in each other's eye. Hi. Or are you really asking, does Joan Baez know that she knows me? Whenever you ask somebody, do you know somebody, what you're really asking is, does that somebody know you?
That's my story, and that's yours. Great. All right. Good. Where did this happen? Because I've seen a picture. I've actually seen a picture of you in your study there. I think you and Joan Baez as your sister, Mimi, sitting with guitars playing. Where did that happen?
At Esalen during a Joan Baez Folk Festival.
Oh, very good. Got to jam with her for a little bit there.
Well, not you.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Simon and Garfunkel were there.
You bet.
The Chambers Brothers were there. Let's see, who else was there? Judy Collins, who I got to know very well because her mother is a Unitarian in Denver. And, all right, what's next, dude?
Well, let's stay in that same vein for a while. Just flip over one page. I thought I like Vanishing Species as well. Yeah.
I'm 76, so. I was born on a planet almost 76 light years from here, an idyllic world where children grew up without the threat of nuclear holocaust or ecological strangulation. No instant systems of communication, no black revolutions, gay revolutions, drug revolutions, no woman's liberation, not even the choice of taking or not taking the pill. And Eden, really. True, the seed of all this was there, but had nothing to do with my formative years. And now I find myself come to this harsh place, a kind of space traveler having close encounters with my own children. Like creatures from different star systems, we stare at each other across the void. Even our words have different stems. We are aliens in each other's midst. But damn it, I am the one saddled with the memory of that other place, part of a colony stranded on the planet Earth at the end of the 20th century, marooned with no way to go back and no time to go on. Like a moon being eclipsed, my kind will soon be gone. And in light of the headlines today, the sooner, the better. A Catholic says, give me a kid until he's five, and we'll set him for life. I mean, but if he does leave the Catholic faith, he will spend the rest of his life rebelling against what. And when you think that I spent 16 years on a planet so unlike the one we're living on, it's a miracle I can talk to anyone under 40.
Well, you certainly do that, though.
Well, I can be cool, too, dude.
All right. No, I do. I think, when was it? During the 60s, 70s, it was kind of just a pilgrimage of people coming up to your place there?
My wife was really thrilled by that. we always had a group of hippie kids. I was a hippie guru at the time, and Big Sur was Mecca. And it seemed like every kid in every college in America decided to go to Mecca and visit Rick Mastin. And my wife said one day, enough. Put a little sign down there. If you haven't called, don't come.
You were in quite a procession. So I'm still staying in touch with you. Come back and see you now.
Well, yeah, all these 60-year-old hippies who have kids named Sky Blue.
Well, let's see. We're going to shift to another genre here because another thing that we share in common is that we are both sports fans, like lots of people in New England here in this congregation. Can tell you, I kind of live and die with the Red Sox, and the Sox are in the World Series this year, just not the right one. But yeah. Well, like I said, I was in Chicago last weekend at a conference, and I managed to slip away to a. I was at a conference center up in the Lincoln Park section of Chicago, and I managed to slip away to a sports bar as the White Sox were playing the game that eventually got them into the World Series. I gotta say, it was at least, I was able to stand there and watch everybody celebrate and say, okay, you guys, we had our party last year, and you're having yours this year. So it was that kind of made the season sort of okay, I guess, to be able to see somebody else's celebration. You know, the Patriots are not off to their usual start, kind of limping along a little bit this
you
year.
To be a 49er fan. I got to tell a story. I was doing it. This was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and it was the third Super Bowl, the one that Joe Namath won.
And Dick Norsworthy, the minister, and I were watching the game, and it wasn't going to be over till the church where I had a gig at 4 o'clock. And he looked at me and I said, "We can't leave this game." And we got to the church about 25 minutes late, full of men who had been dragged to hear the folks in the church. And everybody knew, and that was the worst audience I ever played for.
They don't give enough seeing the end of the game that you got to see it. Yeah. Well, that's a good lead into the well number 111, which is called "For Such a Brutal Primitive Sport, I Must Apologize."
Ladies, I hate to admit it, but there are times when I find I am completely resigned from the Neanderthal Club. Old Og still needs a way to deal with pent-up aggression, explaining perhaps why the trip to the Super Bowl has become such a national obsession. But then, isn't it more humane and genteel to tame the beast vicariously? To sit harmlessly watching a field where padded, paid professionals hit and flog each other, isn't this better than taking it out on the wife, the kids, the dog, and your mother? To say nothing about just possibly reducing the risk of World War III. Ladies, I put it to you, isn't football really the civilized thing to do?
By that, yes, right. Well, let's see. Running my list here, okay. I know you've had, how long has your website been up now, the Words in One Liners?
About 6 years, and I call it my cybergation. Okay. And I have about 2,000 people, and if you're interested, go pick up a card. You just email me and say I want on the list, and every Saturday evening, so it will be on your cyber lawn, on Sunday morning, I post a one-line drawing with the poem, and if you have real audio, you can hear me reading it. And then it's like standing in the doorway of a church as the people file out, because the next day, I'll get about 50 or 60 emails from people saying, "You're sure full of it this week," which I assume can happen at the door of the church as they file. Yeah. And so if you're interested, I'd certainly love you to become one of my cybergents. And if you know anybody with prostate cancer, and I am terminal, but I've fought the good fight. Something I learned, my poems are found along the way. And just 2 nights ago, when I was doing in Manhattan, I did a support group, prostate cancer support group meeting of about 60, 70 men. And I've become the poet laureate of prostate cancer. And I did a reading, and a guy stood up afterwards, and he said, "You're the first person who's come along, and you don't make me feel like a cancer survivor. Survivor is such a kind of passive, negative. It brings up pictures of sitting on a desert island with one palm tree looking at the horizon, having..." He said, "I like it because you are a cancer fighter." And so I'm going to get a poem out of that.
Sounds good.
And that, so any of you have any ideas about anything, tell me, because the only way I get my poems is from people, what people say. Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's because I know it's been part of your website every week is the Prostate Cancer Odyssey, where you talk about how that's all going with you. I just thought, Rick, if you could read a couple of poems from that genre. I've got number 55 is PSA Dread. I forgot to write it down, but I thought I like House of Drips as well. Did you do?
Sure, I'll do both of them. Which
page? PSA Dread is 155. I don't have the number for House of Drips here, but maybe
you can
leak around and find it. Yeah, okay.
PSA Dread. Yeah. The battle with the big sea monster is scored by the numbers. Like a jury trial, digits sequester and deliberate, bringing in a verdict every 6 weeks. Under a microscope, the blood I bled is analyzed, the evidence scrutinized, the side effects of these proceedings PSA dread. In capital cases such as mine, the deliberations never end, and over time I've been both acquitted and condemned. The only constant being the tide of apprehension that ebbs and flows, invisible as air, in my belly, in my brain, even seeping into positive lab results. PSA dread. Shackled to trepidation, I willingly take the stand to share the experience with others, publicly bearing witness in my writing. With pencil in hand, I'm able to stare the prosecutor down and free myself with the cutting edge of testimony like this. And this is how I survive. This is why I am still alive. Most prostate cancer groups are more interested in the medical side. You know, what is the new trials? What? And I'm interested in that. But half of it is the spiritual side. I call developing spiritude. One half being spirit, whatever that is to you, and the other half is attitude, especially with doctors. Because we live in this new planet. I came from a planet where the doctor, the minister, the judge, the teacher were all higher than me in the chain of command. But now I am the captain of the ship. And I'm looking for navigators. And the other thing, well, here's the one he wants. And the one-liner is a chemo. I don't know if any of you have had chemo or a drip like that. And I have, for those people, only you will get the joke, a watched plastic bag never empties. I always like to sort of introduce this like I'm talking about a house of ill repute. There is an address on El Dorado where I go and climb the stairs. I've learned to get there early before clients fill the chairs. It's best to be the first whose name is sweetly paged before these lovely working girls have all become engaged. Gathered in the parlor, beauties one and all, and I never know which cutie will lead me down the hall. But it really doesn't matter. All are deft at what they do. So let the act of drawing straws determine who accesses who. When Vivian steps forward, I know my day is made. You'll notice she's left-handed as she plies her trade. And I'm filled with expectation as I open shirt and vest, for Vivian's corpus callosum is larger than the rest. And if you want to know what a corpus callosum is, you can just ask me afterward. Allison, tall and slender, she gets my second look. She says when she's not working, she curls up with a book. She once did something extra, I mean, at my request. So Allison instructed me to pay at the front desk. Flu shot. And Nora, that Irish beauty, speaks with an Irish brogue. Methinks that Nora thinks I'm a wee bit of a rogue. But I surmise she's drawn to me like gravy to a spud. For Nora loves to needle me until she draws my blood. And Lindy, laughing Lindy, let me tell you, she's the one. Because every time she does me, she makes it loads of fun. When Lindy runs the session, it gives me such a rush to have her waltz into the room and give my port a flush. I call and make appointments like every other John. It's to the House of Drips I go each week to get it on with four oncology nurses. Yes, that's who this is about. The four angels of mercy I cannot live without. You know what I decided if this afternoon if people return, And if they happen, if somebody happens to call out one of the numbers that you heard this morning, I will just turn and read the one on the next page, so you don't have to hear anything.
Well, there's a plan. All right.
Well, you can see we're begging people to come.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
I did once do at Notre Dame, the Unitarian minister there, and what is it, where Notre Dame is. Yeah, where the Christ and they kick field goals through the Christ. And that mosaic was done by Unitarians, which I love. And did you know that Malachi standing on the top of the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City was sculpted by a Unitarian? I love to tell people when we went through, I said, did you know you have a Unitarian standing on the top of, what? What did you want now? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Keep going. No. We'll move towards the last part of your book there. It has to do with some of your philosophical, religious, spiritual thoughts, and one that I particularly like, if I would use to move toward a close here. We are going to do Let It Be a Dance, but let's do, let's try Rainbow's End, number 177. I think I
look
at that right.
177, well, it isn't. I'll read whatever. Like I say, they don't know what I mean. It was just a run. Oh, this is, by the way, a folk. So I used to be a folk singer. And the reason I quit folk singing is I can't remember my lyrics. And I did a gig with Pete Seeger down in New York City once, and a whole bunch of us were there, and everybody was singing, and I'm up there reading, because when you pull a blank in a song, the melody goes on, So I decided, you know what? Poets get to take their book up in front, and if I lose my place, the audience just thinks I'm lost in thought while I try to get it. It was just a rundown truck stop, a greasy spoon cafe. 20 years behind me now, seems like yesterday. I was on my way to somewhere to pull off some big deal, like every kid of 20, the inventor of the wheel. I had scrambled eggs and coffee, a piece of buttered toast, and the drivers at the counter were more talkative than most. And when the subject wasn't women, they talked about the road and the miles that they had traveled and the weight of the load. Funny, ain't it funny, how it all comes round again. It was just a roadside truck stop, and they called it Rainbow's End. And I sat there feeling empty as those poor devils spoke. If that was all there was to life, then it's a short length of rope. But remember, I was 20, and I've covered ground since then. I've picked up on philosophy. A Greek became my friend. I've looked into religion, read Sartre's and Camus. Been up on the mountain with an old guru. When the subject isn't women, they talk about the road and the miles that they have traveled and the weight of the load. Funny, ain't it funny, how it all comes round again. It was just a roadside truck stop, and they called it Rainbow Zen.
All right, thanks a lot. Thank you. Yeah, all right. Before we sing with you, tell a little story about how you came to write. I think you told me this, but I'm always glad to hear it again. So how you came to write
Let It Be a Dance.
Maybe you can do the words for us, and then we'll send you help us out. And we'll
a lot of people are always curious where things come from. In our high school, where all my kids are now, my kids are 47, 48, 50, and 53. For the first 5 years of our life, children fell like rain. And this happens in every high school, probably every 5 years or so, one of those horrible tragedies. My three daughters, they were all in high school at the same time, joined the dance troupe. And I had a marvelous first year young teacher who had these kids dancing like a Broadway troupe. And she heard that the Alan Ailey dancers were going to be in San Jose. So she phoned up her 18 girls and said, you know, if you really want to be uncomfortable and crowd into the Volkswagen bus, we can go up to San Jose and you can really see what dance is all about. My oldest daughter was knitting a sweater for her boyfriend, and she didn't want to, she loved the teacher and loved the dance troupe, but she didn't want to drop a stitch. So she was the one with the driver's license, so she didn't go, and my other two daughters didn't go. The mothers of two other kids didn't want their kids going. And coming back that night, that Volkswagen bus full of young women, some drunk going 100 miles an hour, head on into it, and killed the young teacher and the two girls in the front seat. And a number of the kids in the back seat were very badly injured. Barbara Brussel, who is now a well-known diva, cabaret singer in New York City, and we're doing a CD together. She's singing my old songs, and I'll read poems with her. Anyway, her sister was one of the girls in the front seat who was killed, and Barbara had her knee smashed so badly that the doctor told me out in the hall that he didn't ever think she certainly would never dance again, and would probably need a cane for the rest of her life. So we went in, and there's Barbara, really sad times, and Barbara's foot was up like this, and just as it was time to go, I turned around to Barbara and I said, I'm gonna make you a bet. I'm gonna bet you that 1 year from this date, we established what day it was, that you're gonna come dancing up our country road, and not only that, I'm going to write you the song that you will dance to. And one day, and by the way, exactly a year from that day, here came Barbara, limping but dancing. And I thought it would make a good cover for, I was doing LPs then, and so we had two still photographers, one professional and another one, and one of those old camcorders recording the event. And this makes, you know, I'm not a spook kind of guy, but two cameras unrelated to each other and a video tape all came out gray, flat, nothing. Maybe some things are not meant to have pictures taken of them, but they are meant to have songs written about them. So let it be a dance we do. May I have this dance with you through the good times and the bad times too. Let it be a dance. Let a dancing song be heard. Play the music, say the words, and fill the sky with sailing birds. And let it be a dance. Learn to follow. Learn to lead. Feel the rhythm. Fill the need to reap the harvest. Plant the seed and let it be a dance. Everybody turn and spin. Let your body learn to bend. And like a willow with the wind, let it be a dance. A child is born, the old must die. A time for joy, a time to cry. So take it as it passes by and let it be a dance. The morning star comes out at night. Without the dark, there can be no light. And if nothing's wrong, then nothing's right. So let it be a dance. Let the sun shine, let it rain, share the laughter, bear the pain. But right here, I want you all to take out a pen. The hymnal committee misspelled bear. I meant it to be spelled B-A-R-E. I sent it to them spelled B-A-R-E. What's wrong with the whole culture is we are burying it when we should be bearing it. So just cross it out and put it spelled right. And if you're ever in somebody's church, you got a little 1 minute sermon you could get during the announcements and get them to change some stuff.
Page
311. 311 is where we'll be singing from in a minute. So share the laughter, bear the pain, and round we go again. So let it be a dance.